You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate
and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world.
And now, innovation thought leader
and your super fly host,
Tamara Kleinberg.
What is up, Launch Streeters? Tamara here, your host, innovation enabler, and proud human to a 90-pound Mastiff. She thinks all my ideas are amazing. Okay, seriously, peeps. Have you ever wondered why some businesses are just so complex, so many layers to it? I mean, does it even need to be that way? Does that complexity add to the business? Is it even necessary? I often wonder that. And so did Matt Scanlon, CEO and co-founder of Nadam. They make cashmere sweaters and apparel. He took this amazing journey to Mongolia's Gobi Desert and purchased 40 tons of cashmere with 3 million cash packed in plastic bags. No joke. So his company actually pulled out the complexity, or as he'd say, the unnecessary fat. And there is a lot of it in the apparel and specifically the cashmere world. He didn't just create a disruptive product. He created a disruptive business. Now, as you listen to his journey, you'll hear how at every turn he realized and actually really asked the question, why is this necessary? Why do we do it this way? And as you listen, I want you to think about where you are in your business or industry and if you can do what Matt did in cashmere. It's incredible. Here we go. Hey, Matt, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm so excited to learn more about, well, everything.
Thanks for having me.
So, what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
I'm a homebody. I really don't love traveling, which is definitely a contrast to our entire business model and our founder story. When I first got lost in the middle of the Gobi Desert and eventually came up with Nadam, it was a crazy trip, but that was the first time in my life I had ever done anything like that. So it was a super overwhelming experience.
So let me ask you this, though. Do you not like travel because you'd rather, you know, kick up your feet, read a good book, put on the fireplace? Or is it more just the hassle of, you know, flying, packing, just everything?
I like to kick up my feet, you know, like I love being home. I always have. It's just who I am.
Yeah.
So sometimes the hassle of travel can be frustrating, but yeah, I'm definitely like through and through a natural homebody.
That, well, given what we're about to talk about, I think the audience is going, okay, well, so am I. So what? But once we hear the story, I think they're going to say, wait a minute, what? He wants to stay at home.
No, I know. Well, sometimes I'm worried that when I actually tell people that, they'll be so disappointed,
right.
Like not love what we're doing, and I sometimes hesitate to say it, but it's honestly who I am. I really can't fight it. You find out one way or another eventually.
Well, maybe that's what made your experience so high impact for you, though. So let's dig into that, because I want to start with the story of you and your co-founder traveling into Mongolia's Gobi Desert and purchasing. Let's see if I got it right. 40 tons of cashmere with $3 million cash that was packed in your plastic bags, in your packs. Will you share that story?
Yeah. Well, so it took us a while to get there. But when we did eventually do that, I took a private loan. It was a hard money loan, which had 12% interest and had to be paid back in a year. So if you default, which is oftentimes very likely on loans like that, you give up whatever the collateral is on that loan. I obviously didn't have any collateral because I was 25 years old. So I had asked my parents to take out a second mortgage to support it, which they did because they believed in me. I ended up paying all that money back with interest. So we're okay. And my parents have a place to live.
Let's just start there.
Outside of that, I'd taken the cash from an investor who actually is from Edinburgh, from abroad, and hadn't really disclosed exactly how I was going to facilitate the purchases. And I wired the money from our account to an account in Mongolia. I arrived in Mongolia 3 weeks later, and I withdrew that cash from the bank. But I didn't really understand how much money this was. I mean, have you ever seen $3 million in cash?
I mean, maybe in the movies in a suitcase. I don't know.
You know, it does not fit in a suitcase. It is an enormous amount of money, just like physically. It's an enormous amount of money, and it weighs a ton. no bank, even here in New York City, for instance, would be able to withdraw that much cash at the time. They're not built for it. If you take $3 million out of a bank, there's like a run on the bank. You've taken out all their available cash. So now imagine being in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, which is – it's the coldest capital in the world. It's one of the most remote places in the world. It is, for all intents and purposes, a third world country. And we arrive at a bank and ask to take $3 million out, and they had literally a heart attack. So we ended up going to six or seven different banks, and every time taking out a little bit more money. We eventually got it all. But also most banks aren't – like, they don't know how to transfer that cash. They don't know what you're taking it out, and there's no system for it most of the time. So they would go get bags, and they didn't have anything. So they bring back like plastic shopping bags. Imagine like a shop bag.
Yeah.
We collected enough of those. It was over 30. It was like 32 or 33 plastic shopping bags filled to the brim with cash. We felt like bank robbers. We put it in the backseat of a Land Cruiser, filled that Land Cruiser's a backseat from the floor to the ceiling all the way back. So that's how much money it is. That's how much space it takes up. And it weighs 65 pounds. So it's a lot. And then we drove 20 hours off-roading the entire way in the middle of the Gobi Desert to buy a little bit more than 40 tons of cashmere. Again, that's hard to grasp how much material that is. That is 20 tractor trailers.
Oh my gosh. So let me back up for a second, because I'm a little bit more familiar, obviously, than our listeners are. What inspired you to say, you know what, I'm going to go to the desert, I'm going to take out $3 million in grocery bags, and I'm going to go buy some cashmere? Like, what were you trying to accomplish even with that?
So the story kind of begins a couple of years before that. I had came up as an analyst in a banking program in New York and became really disillusioned with working 17 hours a day and not loving what you do. I felt like I was going to cut myself short in the future, never kind of realizing my full professional potential by not being in love or impassioned by the things I wanted to do. So I quit, and a couple of weeks later took a trip to Mongolia. Of all places, where I had met up with Diedrich, who's one of my co-founders, and he has a banking background, but mostly in econometrics, which is a type of banking that forecasts currency exchange rate fluctuations, and he was interested in emerging markets. So he ended up in Mongolia. So we go, we arrive, we don't know anybody or anything. We get taken on a trip. Our second day there, out to the countryside. We think a trip to the countryside lasts an hour and a half, and we get to meet nomadic herders. And we knew it was going to be touristy, but that's not what happened. We drive for an hour and a half and start off-roading, and then we off-road for 20 more hours into the middle of the Gobi Desert, a super remote area called the Outer Gobi. And the car had broken down. We got out of the car. We got on the backs of motorcycles with strangers. We off-road deeper in the middle of the night. I'm so tired. I can barely hold on to the stranger I'm holding on to in the back of this motorcycle. We get to where we're going. We meet this family of nomadic herders. It is an overwhelming experience. I am like beside myself. I'm also jet lagged, and the elevation is messing with me, and I'm super tired and totally out of it. We end up in this gir in the middle of nowhere. We wake up in the morning and we're like, oh my God, like, where the hell are we? We adjust, we go to the people that took us out there, and we say, okay, cool, like, can we go home? And they had mentioned to us that this was a trip they were planning. I guess we didn't really understand the extent to which they had been planning it, but they were going to stay for a month. And the alternative for us was stay with us for a month, no big deal, or find your own way home. We obviously never found our own way home. We lived with this family in the middle of the Gobi Desert for a month. No running water, no electricity, no communication with the outside world, no food, no clothing. And we were totally taken in and taken care of by this family. After the shock had dissipated, we started to get what I would call comfortable, not really comfortable, but kind of comfortable. And we got to know the family. And what we learned was that these families, and there's a lot of them, there's 1.5 million people in Mongolia that live like this, half the population, they produce 16% of the country's GDP by selling the material that comes out of the animals, which are, these are cashmere goats, and they harvest cashmere from them. And we didn't put it all together at first, but what we realized was they were marginalized and controlled by big macro influences that they had no control over, whether it was climate change or big economic shifts or political changes. They just were at the very, very bottom of this value chain and got more or less the short end of the stick and were super marginalized by it all. We left finally and came up with the crazy idea that we were going to we were going to find a way to help. And so we did the trite millennial thing and said, let's start a nonprofit. We did a Kickstarter with no idea what we were doing to raise money for the nonprofit. We started investing that money in the nonprofit, and we thought we were saving the world. You know, we thought we were the coolest guys. We were figuring it out. And we go back a year later and we have totally failed. Nothing we planned to do worked, right? The theory for us was really simple. Invest in microeconomic development. So invest in things that improve their livelihood. So we invested in veterinary programs and breeding programs because all they wanted was healthier animals and more animals because that's how they made money. What we didn't understand at that time was that ultimately, no matter how valuable we made that fiber become, it was up to traders who arrive in these regions to pay more for it. And if they don't want to pay more for it, they just don't, right? There's only a few of them that arrive at a time. They fix the market. They all agree on pricing. They keep it super low so that the herders continually get screwed. We didn't think that was fair. Those middlemen take a huge profit that is hidden from the rest of the world. There are commodity prices for cashmere, but no one ever sees this part of it. And we were really frustrated because these are people who, remember, took us in,
right,
and clothed us for nothing. So what drove us to do this? Wanting to help, wanting to change something, wanting to be impassioned and love what we did. We had no idea it was going to take us to where we are today. We had no idea that it was going to result in a system of values that would be shared with hundreds of thousands of people all over the world at this point. So we did something crazy because we felt like the position that these herders were in was crazy. And the only solution was to offset those market dynamics. So what do? We come in and we said, we're going to be the traders. Those guys that are paying you $2, screw them. We're going to pay you $4. We're going to buy so much material that they're forced to buy at our $4 price. They were normally buying it $2 and selling for $8. Now they're going to have to buy it $4 and sell for $8 or $10 or whatever. We don't care, right? Because we're going to help you guys. In doing so, what we're able to do is control our pricing of material, force prices up for everybody else, continually improve our circumstance and help the herders. And that's what it was about. Everything else from that point on has been a very, very steep learning curve. Imagine getting literally hundreds of thousands of kilos of cashmere back to the capital of Ulaanbaatar and then having to figure out how to turn that into material that can be turned into sweaters. That's when the challenge became.
So if I understand right, I mean, so I'm a little bit with the jaw on the ground because it's so fascinating to me, particularly the part about the macroeconomics of it all, because, you know, I think of myself, you know, so I go to New York City, I go to Bergdorf, I buy a cashmere sweater, I pay a lot of money for it, and that's that. But to hear the kind of the chain reaction, I suppose, or the chain that that's really a part of, that I'm only a small kind of piece of it. And I think if I understand your business right, what you guys have done with Notum, make sure I'm saying it right, because we had this whole conversation offline, listeners, about saying different names right, is really you've cut out the middleman and said, okay, we're going to go right to these herders. We're going to offer them a much fairer value for what they do, a higher value, which is going to disrupt the chain completely, but also provide an amazing product to the market that helps these people live better lives. Is that a fair kind of high level of what you ended up doing from all of this?
Yes, with one added fit, that doing all of this ultimately results in an unparalleled degree of transparency. And that transparency allows us to continually improve the quality of the product. That is unlike anything else in the world, right? So for us, what this the really boiled down version of that explanation was that sustainability leads to transparency, quality, and affordability. That's it. That's what we believed in. The reason we dedicate ourselves to this now, because we want that message to be as amplified as possible. We think the rest of the industry has been doing it wrong. We think that our way is right. We think the way we're doing it is real. This is real sustainability for real people using real materials. That's it, right? We make it simple for ourselves at this point because I can't go around giving a 15-minute explanation everywhere.
Right, yeah. Well, I want to dig into something you said for launch readers because I think it's really valuable. So you just said that transparency equals an improved product and transparency being so important. I don't want to be assumptive. So talk to me a little bit about that because I think I get it. It kind of, high level makes sense. But why is that so important and why does that actually lead to an improved product?
Because specifically within natural materials, there's a lot of disinformation. There's a lot of misunderstanding of what it is you're actually getting and why something's cost more money. You don't really know why what you bought at Brugdorf Goodman is better than another alternative. And the reality is, at this point, most people know it. There's crazy markups along that value chain that have been built into that traditional sales supply chain. So what we felt was important was kind of learning all of this so that we could tell people what was really happening. And the only way to do that was to have transparency into all of it. But what transparency for us really boils down into is that I go and I watch them comb the material out of the goats, right? I ensure that that's a humane process. I then watch them sort that material into different values, right? So some is better than others. I watch them do it. I then make sure that it gets categorized exactly as I need it. I then watch it get put on a truck, make sure that that truck, their route, it has the lowest emissions possible. Make sure that that supply chain we build is the most effective utilization of that supply chain for the environment. I then make sure that that material gets processed appropriately. I understand how it gets washed and eventually dehaired. I understand the moisture levels in the facility, ensuring that it's the highest degree of quality, but also the most efficient, which efficiency is sustainability. And if you're efficient about how you interact with your environment, you're environmental. And so that's the equation I want to create for people, that if you watch everything, you know that it's done right. If you trust my value system, right, and there's a lot of trust here, but if you trust my value system, then you trust that if I'm the one that watches every single stage of this manufacturing development process, that I'll ensure a certain set of values are implemented at every stage, ultimately resulting in a transparent value system. A definition of what that value system is, and ultimately a better product at a lower cost. And that's it. Like, this shouldn't be so complicated anymore. I have nothing to do with fashion, right? I didn't come from this industry. I never knew anything about it before. And I was so frustrated with all the disinformation, that so much of what we're fed is marketing bullshit. It drives me crazy. And so what has come to define our brand today is something so, so basic. We are real, right? The things we do are real and genuine and honest. And for us, the new aspiration of fashion is not to be couture or whatever. It's to be genuine and real. That's what people should be striving for. And that's what we share with you. And it results in a real value proposition that we can hang our hat on that ultimately results in a really strong audience dedication to why we do what we do.
You know, I have to tell you, as you were saying that about all the marketing bullshit, it reminded me of, I used to do new product development, a lot of it for consumer packaged goods, you know, things you find in Target and Safeway, whatever. And one of the things I came to learn was that the reason some products are in the refrigerator aisle is because you can charge more for them, not because they actually need to be refrigerated. And I remember like that blowing my mind when I was 27 and be like, are you kidding me? Like that, I just paid $2 more for that because you decided where to put it. That's it. Oh my God. Like that's crazy.
There's so much that I disagree with around branding and marketing, but I love it at the same time, right? Like I love communication. That's what drove us initially to build this business. It was that communication we developed with these communities. And I felt like, wow, they have a really interesting value system. They believe in honor and respect and these things that get communicated in our interaction, but I just don't see other places. I want other people to see that. And so we named our company Nottam, not because of it had anything to do with Mongolia, but the fact that Nottam's the name of a festival in Mongolia that celebrates the people. And so we are here as a company to celebrate the people and the places that the things we own come from. And we want to tell that story regardless of where it comes from.
Well, I think what's cool to do in today's landscape with social media technology, internet, all of that good stuff, you can do that now in a way you couldn't do that 20 years ago. I want to flip and ask a little bit of a different question now, because what you've really done is, and you said it yourself, you disrupted an entire industry and said, we're not going to do it the way everybody in this industry is doing it. I mean, it was very set in stone, right? Like this is the chain, this is the path, this is where the money in the middle is really taken up. What resistance or hurdles did you face in trying to completely disrupt this industry, and how did you overcome them?
So this is I have a very interesting, probably fairly telling response. Very little resistance on the supply chain side. Very little, right? I mean, you know, this is capitalism. It happens. There's really no violence here. People will just come in and buy alongside us at the same price, and we just built our supply chain. That's it. The biggest resistance has been from the audience, has been from the consumers who just aren't used, right? Their bullshit detectors go up through the roof as soon as they hear something like this because they've been lied to so many times. So the biggest challenge for us is almost every – we have a brand video. Every time I show the video, which tells a story I just articulated for you, people look at me and they go, is this real, quizzically, right? Because – they're used to seeing so much of this that is fake. And the biggest challenge that I face is convincing people that I'm not full of shit, that what I do is driven by a real sense of a real passion and sense for what makes me happy and what I think I am here to do. You know, not to be too idealistic, but I really have to boil it down for people. That's been the biggest hurdle, honestly.
So I get it, right? Like I was just thinking the number of actually requests for podcast interviews that come across my desk from companies who are claiming to do what you're just saying, disrupt the category, do it differently, take out the middleman. You know, on one side, on the other hand, we have companies like Tom Shoes and Warby Parker that I think did it in different ways that kind of set the stage. So what did you do to get the customers to get over that hurdle? Because I hear you. Like, I think it's a real one. And we're balancing this between like, okay, here's all the bullshit and here's some real ones.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I don't think we're over the hurdle yet.
Yeah.
I think we're trying to get over the hurdle, right? I think it takes time. I think there are a couple of things that really move the needle, and they're not as fun to talk about. But if your product is priced the right way and looks the right way, it sells more, right? And more people have it. And the more people have it, the more they just fundamentally agree with the thing that they got. And it's very psychological. We haven't built a big enough business yet to really get over that hurdle of convincing people. We're always testing different ways to communicate with the customer to try and get there a little bit faster. Right. And is it me talking? Right. Is it me on our social channels? Is it me, right? Is that what people relate to? Or is it just the product they relate to? Or do they need to see footage of the places we go? I can't take every single person on this journey with me. Right. I'd love to bring everybody. But building that trust takes time. There is just no short-term solution for it. Real trust is never earned overnight. So, it's just going to take time, and I have to be consistent. If I ever lack consistency in my message, then people start to lose faith in that message. So it's simple. Be consistent and be honest, and that's it. You know, give it time. Give time to time.
Launch readers out there listening, I really want you to take a deep breath, pause, and think about this, because I think oftentimes with what Matt's saying, we think about the resistance coming from the quote-unquote industry itself, but you're talking about the consumer, us, people, and just getting us on board for something different, something new, and believing, to your point, right, that it's actually real. You said something a second ago that I want to dig into. You said you can't bring everyone along. Who are you bringing along then?
I bring a video crew to document it. The reality is, if I bring too many people, I'm hurting more than I'm helping.
Right.
I go into the
community. Then you're adding like fat back to the supply chain, right?
Yeah, there's no reason for that. I most of the time I go by myself, or you know, Dietrich and I go, and we go with you know our logistics crews and nonprofit, and we're doing you know meaningful work. Nowadays, I don't even do most of the purchasing myself. Dietrich will go with his team. And I like to go and do the nonprofit work. So I'll be there in May, and we will be kicking off a new nonprofit effort around building basically an auditorium in the area where we do most of our work or purchasing for school children. That's our focus this year. Last year, we built a fence the size of Manhattan, a durable winter fence to preserve grasslands and offset desertification issues in the region. Year before that, we inoculated 1 million goats for 1,500 herders. I always feel kind of shitty when I bring a video crew because I'm like, why? Like, I feel like I should just do work and do good for the community. Why do I have to prove it all the time? Why do I have to, I feel like I'm bastardizing the things that are meaningful to me by having to market it all the time. So it's definitely an internal conflict for me, but you know, how else can I do it, right?
Well, the flip side to that is you can do all the great work in the world, and you have a product, but if nobody knows about it, it's not sustainable on your side.
Exactly. I mean, so, early on when I first started, I felt like, man, if I could just sit in front of every single person and tell them this story, they would believe. I can't do that.
Yeah. Well, let me flip the question for a second. From the customer perspective, who do you think are the first ones to jump on board? Who are the ones that you're bringing along? Because I do find with purpose-driven brands, whatever it is, we all say we want that. You know, if you took a survey, right, 99% of us would be like, yes, we are totally, we buy everything to make sure sustainability and green. But if you actually look at our habits, we're very selective about the things that we do, and not selective in the sense of I'm thoughtful, but selective in the sense of it actually has to benefit me too.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the early adopters are always people that are initially just aligned to this kind of thinking, right? They're susceptible. They're believers, I should say. They want to believe that I'm being honest. And so they're there and they're purchasing product and they're evangelizing on social media and telling their friends, and that's great. Predominantly, though, our audience is made up of millennials who don't have as much disposable income. And so if I can't price the products and style the products in a place that they want to purchase, then they don't get to do the evangelizing, right? They don't want to go telling people about a product they can't afford. And so I have to align those things first. But I do find that consumer, younger generations, are more adaptable to our type of thinking. I am a millennial, right? I mean, my value system, I think, is a very ubiquitous one nowadays. So I think there's a big opportunity for us, and it's increasingly becoming more important every day. But the best chance we have at building our audience and kind of getting to initial groups of people is making sure we price the product and put the product in a place that consumers actually want to buy. That's it, right? I mean, at the end of the day, this is product market fit. All consumer businesses fundamentally are built off of that framework.
It's kind of what you said earlier, isn't it? The things that are not fun to talk about, but that make the difference.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's less impassioned. I'll be honest with you, right? I mean, it's I think a juxtaposition between talking about how much I love what I'm doing and then having to talk about how to exploit audiences and sell product at the right price. Those things don't always feel genuinely aligned to me. But listen, the bigger we get, the more good we do. And that's like, that's the baseline. That's it, right? So let's work towards that.
Someone, I don't know who said this originally, but someone repeated this quote back to me, which changed how I thought about my business, which was, it takes profit to make change.
Yep.
And that to me said it was like, okay, I got to have a sustainable business. If I'm going to make an impact, I can be in it for the impact all I want. But if I don't have a business model that makes money, I'm not going to grow and I'm not going to reach more people, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. Exactly. I fundamentally at every level agree with that statement. And I'm probably going to use that.
You should. I don't know who said it originally. I've been looking on. I've searched. I cannot find. So if you find it, let me know. But to me, anytime a new business owner comes to me for advice and says, I'm really not in it for the money, I say, then let's wait to have a conversation to when you are. Because money matters. So, and to your point about the original herders that took you in and were so generous and you're trying to impact, they need money too.
They do.
So. So I wanted to ask about milestones and benchmarks. That was the other thing I was curious about. I'm always fascinated when you do it totally differently and there's no real best practice or case study to follow, which I think is great because frankly, I find that following other people's best practices never work for me, even when I've tried it because it worked for them, but my circumstances are different anyway. But how did you figure out your milestones? What were you looking for to say, yes, I'm on the right track, this is working, beyond the touchy-feely? How did you know?
Revenue. Yeah. Making money, right? It goes back to that. There's different degrees of what predict profitability and revenue for us. So finding those predictors was very important. And then we built our business to always react to them very quickly. KPIs around digital growth can tell you a lot, right? If you are selling a lot of product and not a lot of people are returning it, it means the product's good. If you have a really high LTV with your customer, it means they're coming back multiple times over and over again. So
I'm talking about, I just want to make sure for the audience, lifetime value, LTV.
Yes, yep. Sorry.
No, it's okay. We all have our lingo and we forget that other people don't necessarily use it.
Let's do that. So lifetime value is super, super important for us. Low customer acquisition costs means that the value proposition resonates quickly. So when we see these things, we know that what we have is inherently value. It's then up to us to be able to exploit them and continue to grow with those KPIs in mind. Other predictors for us were, you know, industry acknowledgement, the right press evangelizing you, working with the right retailing accounts like a Revolve or a Shopop or Stitch Fix or Net-a-Porter. I mean, they set the tone for what good product is or what meaningful brands are nowadays. So when we are working with them, we know, okay, like we have the ingredients. If this doesn't work, it's not because the idea is not good. It's because we messed it up. So the big focus for me now is getting really, really talented people in our office here in New York. And we're growing a lot and hiring a lot. And the value of the talent that's coming in is beyond my wildest expectations. If people come to me and say, I want to work for your brand, and they are fundamentally talented and smart, I know that I'm targeting the right audience, right? That's like perfect for me. That's the most validation in the world, honestly. And so far, you know, a lot of people come to us and want to work here. They're like, I heard about this. I want to be part of this. I want to make this work. And that's meaningful for me.
For launch readers out there, what I want you to pay attention to in this conversation, and thank you for sharing some of the kind of real specifics around it, is what Matt's talking about are truly predictive indicators, not lagging indicators. I think oftentimes we get trapped looking at lagging indicators that don't actually tell us they're we can't react to them. They're too far gone. So, and I can have a whole conversation about that on a Q&A session another time, but there's a big difference between the two. I wanted to ask you a question about purpose and cause, because you know, it's obviously very important to you personally, to the business. Why do you think in today's economy it's so important to have a purpose or a cause as part of your business? And I mean, really have it, not have a nice ad on a special day, you know, that highlights someone to make you seem like you care.
Technology, first and foremost, has allowed people to access large amounts of information at once, all at once, and showed them what the right way should look like, right? Or allows them to compare and contrast and have transparency, more or less, right? Having a real direction and having a real impact is, I think, noticeable. If you don't have it, you're fundamentally less valuable. And I think it's a predictor of value oftentimes, more so with certain generations, but making sure that those things are aligned and that you are properly explaining them is really, really important. But it goes back to the fact that now more than ever, you have the opportunity because of technology, let's just call it what it is, the internet and Instagram, Facebook, and different media outlets, you can determine who's doing it right and who isn't. And I think it's more important than ever to be aligning these things for people, because if you don't, somebody else will. And that's it.
That's how I end all my keynotes about being innovative. Like, if you don't, somebody else will. So chop, chop. It's, I think it goes back to what you're saying too about transparency, to your point about, like, we know there's no hiding anything now. We know everything that's going on. So I want to actually ask you, this is a little bit of an offshoot question, because you took our innovation assessment. So your innovator archetype, how you innovate, is instinctual fluid, which as I'm listening to you, I'm finding so fascinating. So for listeners out there, instinctual is being able to have more of a circuitous thinking to see and create patterns, connect kind of like A to L to X over to Y. And I think, Matt, what you were talking about, the macroeconomics and the kind of how you saw the global picture based on being off the grid in the middle of nowhere, but how you kind of put that all together as part of that instinctual. And then the fluid side are, this is actually a rare one. It's kind of interesting to me. It's people who create innovation in ambiguity and fog. So I find that people who have fluid tend to be really good at creating all new paths where it seems really foggy, unclear, messy. What do we do? Like, you can actually take that, what do we do, and turn it into innovation. So I'm curious how your ability to see patterns and kind of connect those dots that other people don't connect, and to navigate those kind of muddy, kind of messy waters, has helped you build a disruptive business, because it's an interesting combination.
Yeah, well, I have to be honest, it's not so much about me as it is being humble enough to collaborate and take suggestions all the time, right? It's less about connecting the big points and sifting through a collaborative conversation to points that are meaningful to then add up and make a decision. And so that's why a team, having a strong team, is so important to me, because I alone, I don't think of myself as like a big archetypal thinker connecting big points. I really I value other people's opinions. I don't think, most of the time, I don't think I'm the smartest person in the room, and I really prefer not to be. If I am, there's a problem. So I rely on other people oftentimes, and I sift through their suggestions and their thinking. So it's very psychological for me. I'm always trying to think through, okay, what is their opinion? Why is this their opinion? And then I weigh it against somebody else's. Conversely, what their opinion is and why that's their opinion. Always kind of assessing different levels of psychology. I think from a macro perspective, what we're looking at is the industry we're in is murky and foggy. Retail is changing.
Yeah, and drastically.
And the only thing that's constant about this industry is the change. I find that to be an opportunity for us, because the way we can do it can be the right way. I hate more than ever when people tell me, well, this is how it's done. I look at it and I say, well, I don't know. I can tell you, I can point out 10 other instances where how this is done is wrong and failing right this second. So let's think about a different way to do it. And if you don't agree with me, fine, I'm going to figure out how to do it on my own, and then I'll come and show you the results. And maybe I'll be wrong, right? And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with failing and living in that kind of ambiguity. There are times where ambiguity, I'll just be very, very transparent, is crushing for me. It's debilitating, right? It's a very difficult way to live when you don't know anything. It feels like you don't know what tomorrow is going to be like.
It's exhausting. And so, it takes a lot of work.
It is exhausting. And I think there's certain personalities that just do well in those circumstances.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that it doesn't stress me out and drain me. And there aren't times where I feel like everything is falling on me all at once. But I can handle it. I think I have a fairly high threshold for emotional ambiguity and pain.
And the pain that comes along with it. I just have to say, though, Matt, I'm smiling and doing, you know, if I could do jumping jacks without it messing with my microphone, I would, because you said sifting through other people's perspectives to find the meaningful points is exactly what I'm talking about with instinctual. So it's so to like connect all those dots and to find the good stuff, like in the ambiguity. It's so good. But the other thing, so I think that's really cool, because it shows to me how you've really unleashed your strengths. But there's a second layer to what you said, which is about recognizing that other people in the room have perspectives and knowledge and experience you should listen to. And I think that oftentimes is the make or break between great leaders and great companies and teams, is being that person at the top that says, okay, yeah, I have a perspective and opinion and things I bring to the table, but so do the 7 other people in the room. And I should be put myself in a position to listen to those people too.
Well, yeah, I think it has a lot to do with just self-awareness. I think the best leaders are super self-aware, and it's good to know what you know, right? It's good to know that, hey, this is my perspective on how I want this brand to look, and I stick to it. But I also am very aware of the things I don't know. And kind of making sure that those two things match up to make decisions is really, really important, because my job at the end of the day is always just to make decisions. I'm a decision maker, and that's like really it. So being able to have a process for myself that allows me to make decisions quickly and efficiently is the most important part of what I do.
Well, and I agree. And I would say to that too, that particularly with my team, I come up with ways to do things and stuff to do. And I tend to be very declarative. I don't use question marks very often. And they have a running joke about my lack of ability to use question marks. But they also know to push back. And the truth is, they have more perspective on some things than I do, because they're in it every day. And I'm now removed from that. So if I didn't listen to them, I'd be kind of an idiot, because they're in it every single day.
That's how I feel. It's funny when, you know, we've raised a lot of money, when we bring on investors and things like that, they're like, well, you know, what do you want us to give you? Like, what do you want from us? And I said, not much. Like, there's a couple of big macro points that I need help with around financing strategy and maybe some high level relationship building. But I want to take the advice from the people that are in this office every single day, that actually know what's going on. Because if you give me advice, I can promise you that there's 10 data points you don't have, that as you're telling me your opinion, I'm thinking, well, you don't know this, this, and this. So immediately I start to discount what you're saying, because I need to go to the people that I think have all that information available to them. I've learned so much as I built the company, and I think the thing I've learned the most about is myself. This has easily been the most valuable thing I've ever done in my life.
So were you always this humble or open to other people's perspectives, or did you go into this? And I don't think this is a millennial thing. I mean, I'm a Gen Xer, but I think it's a typical 20-something thing, thinking you know it all.
Yeah. I mean, I think I know certain things, you know what I mean? And then I know that there are things I don't know. You know, having an opinion is really relative. So like in one conversation, I might be developing that opinion, and in another, I might be asserting that opinion, right? So it's a very fluid thing. So I might be talking to an investor and saying, hey, you know, I know this, this, and this. And it might feel like I act like I know exactly what I'm talking about. But I had two conversations before I walked into the room. I didn't know. And I was evolving this perspective in real time. So it's a very relative thing. I think also, and I do think about this a lot, because I love thinking about psychology of founders, because I've seen so many similarities in myself. It becomes a really self-affirming thing when you realize you are a certain way, that you are, that you're a thing that other people are, I should say. That it's like makes sense. Like, oh, that's why I do this thing. And I look at you know, my experience as a kid and realizing that, you know, I had learning disabilities and was in, you know, special classes when I was really little and stuff like that. And it created a humility in me that I think has stayed, which is like, oh man, like people might be smarter than me. Like imagine a 7-year-old kid getting taken out of you know, the regular math class to go to the special math class, you start to feel like, man, you're not as smart as everybody. At this point, I don't feel like that anymore. But that idea of like other people know stuff has always stuck with me. And as I've investigated other entrepreneurs and successful founders, I've seen a thread of that continue. I've also found that that experience fostered a type of thinking that like, I'll figure it out using the tools I have, not the ones I don't have.
Yeah.
Just if I need to get answers on this test, I'll just go to the kid who's the smartest in the class and sit behind him during the test. You know, that's what he asked.
Well, I will another time share with you how I used to get pulled out of class for special reading classes because I had dyslexia, but they didn't know it. They didn't test at the time.
Yeah.
So I had same kind of thing, like every Tuesday, Thursday at, you know, 11:25, I was pulled out of class for the quote unquote stupid class.
I remember that. Girl.
Yeah, it's a vivid memory. It's hard to erase those things. Where before I ask you the last question, where can people go to connect with Nadam, to connect with you? Where do you want them to go?
Just our website, Nadam.co. We're a .co because the guy who owns Nadam.com won't sell it to us because he's cost $80,000, which I think is bullshit, but whatever.
I've had that happen where you're like, why are you holding that hostage? You don't even use it.
Yeah, some people come to us and they're like, oh, a .co, that's so millennial. And I'm like, yeah, if I could get the .com, I would. But .co is fine.
Yeah, it's like, whatever, we'll get there when it's not $8,000. All right, this has been great. I can't believe we're out of time. The last question I want to ask you is, what's the one piece of advice you have for launch readers out there looking to lead change or looking to be a leader in a changing environment?
I mean, it's the kind of what we've been talking about this whole time is have some humility. Right? Like allow other people's opinions and perspectives to develop your own and be humble enough to listen rather than talk all the time. You know, I could talk all day. I'm sure you could probably get that, but I am the most valuable when I'm not talking and when I'm listening.
Well, that is a great note to end on. So Matt, thank you so much. I love what you guys are doing and I'm looking forward to sharing it with the world.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Wait, what did you think? I'm really digging the idea of not just thinking about how to launch an innovative product, but how to launch an innovative business, how to really disrupt the industry itself, the distribution chain, the actual model. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to think about how the industry you work in, how it's built, the entire chain from start to finish, the things that happen before you and the things that happen after you. Then I want you to think about how you would take the complexity out of it. How would you strip away the unnecessary fat? How would you disrupt it? Tamara, out.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.